Genesis chapter 50. It's fun how God puts together services. And this morning service in Sunday school, Jeff made a couple comments, and it ties in exactly with where this one is going this morning. He said as he was looking at suffering, and the suffering of Jesus in particular, compared to the way that we suffer, he said, you know, I suffer poorly because I so often lose sight of the end of the story. Jesus suffered successfully because Jesus never lost track of the end of the story. As we come to the end of the book of Genesis, we come to the end of at least part of the story. We're going to read that in just a moment. But as we read it, we see that the story is not really ended. Joseph, as he bids his brothers, his family, farewell, on this side of eternity, says the story is still awaiting a completion. It's still waiting the end of the story. And basically, as we come to the end of this story, we need to keep in mind that we can and we do know where this story is going. And that's what enables us to play our role and live out our story well. Genesis chapter 50, let's read this chapter together this morning. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it, for that's how many are required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. When the days of weeping for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, I am about to die in my tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan. There shall you bury me. Now, therefore, let me please go up and bury my father. Then I will return. And Pharaoh answered, go up and bury your father as he has made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the household of Joseph, his brothers and his father's household. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. There went up with them both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a great and grievous lamentation. And he made a mourning for his father for 7 days. When the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians. Therefore the place was named Abel Mizraim. It is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field at Machpelah, to the east of Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite, to possess as a burying place. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin, because they did evil to you. And now, please, forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear. For am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's house. Joseph lived 110 years, and Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were counted as Joseph's own. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely visit you. You shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. You've been on trips where it seems like they've been forever. You've gone on those trips where you know where you're going. You think you know how to get there. You want to get there. There's every desire in your heart to get there. But as you get out on the road, you start going on the trip. You go around one curve and then another, and you find out that you have no idea where you are. And it's at that point where you reach over and you click the button on your mirror or your dashboard, and you just check the compass to say, now, which direction am I really going? I'm lost. And you pull out that compass. And we find that as we take journeys, that in order to navigate our journey correctly, we need to constantly bear hard in the direction of the destination. You know which direction it was when you started out. And as you get going on the journey, you have to keep checking that compass to make sure that you're going the right direction. You're going in the direction of your destination. And as we come to this part of the story, we find that this is for us as true as it was for the characters back in the book of Genesis. And as we wrap up the book of Genesis, I hope you're finding in these stories not even familiar stories, stories that you've heard before, the same old yada yada, the same old things that you've taught and you've visited with these friends, and it's like, oh yeah, the story of Joseph. I hope as we come to these stories, you're hearing them again as stories that don't primarily belong only to these people, but these are stories that belong to us. Their stories are given because there are stories. And as they've learned through these events in their lives, God used different names. God used different locations. God used different pressures. God used different things than He uses in your life. But He uses the same pressures to do the same, accomplish the same purposes in your life. They struggle with the same things that we struggle with. They struggle with losing direction in the midst of life's journey. And as this book draws to a conclusion, this text in particular provides for us three ways in which we're freed to live life by knowing where this story is going. We read this morning from the book of Revelations, chapter 20, 21, a little bit in 22. Keeping in mind, this is the direction where we're headed. This is where the story goes. And the Bible always uses the end of the story as an encouragement for us to live out our part of the story well, to live out our part of the story successfully. And so we'll see that that's exactly what happens as these men step out of their story and they quit playing their roles within a story that's much bigger than them. We'll see first of all this morning that knowing where the story is going enables us to focus on the present with clarity. This chapter is broken up basically into three different parts. The first 14 verses talk about the death of Jacob. And you see the last verse of the last chapter 49 there. It says, when Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, he breathed his last, and he was gathered to his people. He died. And that's where verse 1 picks up. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept and kissed him. As the story picks up, verses 1 through 14 talk about the death of Jacob. They're going to take him back to Canaan. They're going to bury him. Verses 15 down through 21
talk about what happens now when they get back to the land. They get back, no more dad. The brothers are concerned about how Joseph's going to treat them now that Jacob's gone and off the scene. Now what turn is their story going to take? And verses 15 through 21 talk through that tension that gets relieved. And then 22 through 26 talks about Joseph's death. And from the time that Jacob dies, Joseph is some 56 years old. By the end of the story, by the end of this one chapter, Joseph is 110 years old. 54 years go by in these few verses. And that's the way the Bible tells the story. It selects different parts and it weaves it together as a whole. And it tells us not as much as we'd like to know. Isn't there a lot in those 54 years you'd love to know? Wouldn't you love to know what Joseph's house looked like? What kind of chariot did he drive? What kind of chariots did he drive? Who got his house when it's all said and done? Did Ephraim inherit the mansion? Did Manasseh get the mansion? Was there two wings? What did this presidential suite look like? What happens afterwards when they go out of Egypt? Who gets the presidential mansion when they're slaves? We're not given all the details, but we're given enough details to tell the story from God's perspective. This is a history that's given from a theological vantage point. And so as this story is told, the end of this story, three different parts: the death of Jacob, the contention with the brothers, and then the death of Joseph. So as we look at the first 14 verses, we see that understanding the end of the story, knowing where this story is going, it frees us to live this life in the here and now with clarity. In verse 1, we see that living life with clarity means that we get to engage in all the proper emotions that life brings us. God has made us emotional creatures. God has made us in His image. We see that even in John chapter 11, verse 35, Jesus Himself, the Son of God, wept. I love in Zephaniah chapter 3, where it talks about God rejoicing over us with singing. Our God knows the full gamut of emotions that He equipped us to be able to experience and know, and He means for us to utilize those emotions. Do you suffer? Well, praise God, we talked about this morning, we have a suffering sovereign. We have a great high priest who is touched with the feeling of our infirmities because He was tempted in all points like we are, but without sin. Praise God, He's made us to be emotional creatures. And the way that we engage with the here and now with clarity is by running through the full gamut of emotions that God has equipped us. And you come to this two times in this passage. We see Joseph is going to be weeping there in verse 1. He wept over him and he kissed him. We see that when the brothers send word to Joseph in verse 17, Joseph wept because they spoke to him in a certain way. He weeps because they speak to him in a certain way. Down in verse 3, end of the verse, the Egyptians wept for 70 days. In verse 10, they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they lamented there with a very great and grievous lamentation, so much so that the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, see them mourning, and they say, this is a grievous mourning. Just because the end of the story is literally rainbows and flowers and colors and rivers of life, just because it ends so beautifully doesn't mean that all the junk of this life isn't real. It doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt. It doesn't mean that it isn't painful. It doesn't mean that we need to suck it up, brush it off, pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, and keep on going like it didn't faze us. It phases us. And that's okay. He says in Thessalonians, is it Thessalonians or is it Corinthians, where he says that we sorrow, but not as those who have no hope. It's okay to sorrow. It's proper to sorrow. When stuff bad happens, when you lose somebody that's close, it would be inappropriate, it would be improper to not sorrow at that point. So just because I know the end of the story doesn't mean I cut off and wrench and choke off my emotions. I am able to engage in the full gamut of emotions, even though I know the end of the story. Good wins. Death dies. Praise God, God gets the victory. That's just a part of living life with clarity in the present. In verses 2 and 3, living life with clarity means embracing the available technologies. In this chapter alone, in all of Scripture, is anybody embalmed? Is any of the characters in the biblical setting embalmed? In verse 2, Joseph commands his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. And it takes 40 days because that's how long it takes. Verse 26, Joseph dies and they embalmed him. And they put him in a coffin in Egypt. Now embalming was an art. That's why today some 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years later, we're able to pull out these mummies and there's still something other than just the bones left. This was an art. This was a technology. And guys, we can talk about it a little bit later about how they would drill up through the nose and pull the brains out. We won't go into that right now. But this was something that they would do. They would take everything out from the inside. They'd stuff it with spices. Then they'd take these strips that were kind of glue strips, and they'd wrap them around, and they'd pull them real tight, and it preserved the body. This was a technology. It wasn't sinful just because the Egyptians used it. Now, it says here that Joseph, in verse 2, commanded his servants, the physicians, to do this. Embalming is neither right nor wrong. It's preserving a body, getting it ready. They had to. They're about to take a trip. He made a promise, Joseph, take my body over to Canaan. Well, you don't just drop it on JetBlue and pick it off when it gets there. Okay? You got to travel there. In the middle of a hot desert, you've got to make sure this body doesn't stink, it's not decaying, that the vultures aren't following your caravan on the way to Canaan. So there's some pragmatic reasons we had to do this. But as Joseph engages the technology of embalming his father, he makes some distinctions. Because embalming was usually done not by the physicians, who are the healers, it's usually done by the priests, because there were religious ceremonies that went along with the embalming. The reason that the Egyptians did embalming was because they believed that the soul needed a tent. It needed a location for the afterlife. And as they would build their pyramids, and the more wealth that you had, the more extravagant you could build, and they would design their pyramids with the stars and line everything up so that soul could be ushered into the afterlife. And they believed that soul needed a body in order to carry on life in the afterlife. And so as they did the embalming, the priests were very heavily involved in the process. Joseph says, you know, this technology isn't bad. Okay, it can be used for bad purposes. It's tied with some bad rituals. But the technology itself isn't bad. I think as I was talking with Evelyn, the chaplain, this week. I think she was born in 1928, so she was just a teenager as World War II broke out. We were talking about all the technological advances that she's seen from 1928 to 2015. Life is so different. The phones that they carried out into World War II, they'd have to wear a backpack and carry this big phone and have these huge batteries and try to communicate, and it's all breaking up. Today, we have more technology in our cell phone than they had in the first rocket that went to the moon. Better computers in your cell phone. Unbelievable. So, we need to avoid technology because it's going to be used by Antichrist. Will technology be used by Antichrist? Probably. Does that make technology bad? No. Okay. It helps you to keep track of your bills. It makes paying bills online easier. It helps you keep track of your information. It helps you do all sorts of work. Technology isn't the problem. Okay, how we use technology is the problem. And we see from this very beginning, I know the end of the story. God's gifted even unsaved individuals to create technology that can be used in appropriate ways, guardedly, but appropriately by us. In verse 4, Joseph makes a request from Pharaoh. Remember, Joseph's number two in all the land. Pharaoh's the only one that's higher than him. So verse 4 comes across to me just a little strange. When the days of weeping for him are past, Joseph speaks, not to Pharaoh, but to the household of Pharaoh, and says, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying I'm about to die," and so on and so forth. He makes this request. Now, why didn't Joseph just march into Pharaoh and say, "Hey, buddy, old pal, why don't you let me go back to Canaan, bury my dad, I'll be right back. Just not a big deal, I'll be right back." Joseph follows all the protocols that are necessary in his context. Now, we don't know why. There's some Egyptian texts that say that if somebody has been with a dead body, that they're not allowed into the presence of the Pharaoh. It may be because Joseph is making a request that he's putting himself purposefully lower than he needs to in order to make this request of Pharaoh, putting himself down and saying, "Please, sir, I'm your servant. I'm just asking this. It doesn't have to be this way, but here's my request." And he follows, we use the term loosely, manners. He follows protocol. Sometimes we forget that protocol is important in the world, in the day and age in which we live. That holding a door for a lady is still matters. That being careful in the way that I talk and presenting the gospel still matters. I've got the truth. There is a heaven, there is a hell. But how I deliver that truth matters, because I can either turn people on or turn people off to the gospel. When we lived back in Minnesota, my dad worked at the tool company, Otana Tool Company. Yeah, in town, we had Pillsbury Baptist Bible College there. And he worked with several of the college students. And there was an excitement as the college students would come in. They'd get jobs and they're working there. And there's this camaraderie of sharing the gospel, being evangelistic in their gospel presentations. And so the guys that my dad was working with, dad was a Christian. He'd shared the gospel with some of them, several of them. And other college students would come through and they'd share the gospel, and some would do it rather attractively. Their life would back up their message. And some would come in and they'd do it rather caustically and just tell them they're on their way to hell, they need Jesus, and just kind of ramming it down their throat. There was this one fella, he was a good guy. And he would always eat his lunch, and he'd eat it with Oreos. He'd eat his Oreos, and he wasn't real careful in the way he ate his lunch. And he would wear Oreos all around his lips, okay? You get the picture. And then, throughout the night, then, he'd go and he'd be telling people about Jesus with Oreos smeared all over his face. Okay, so there was nothing caustic, there was nothing ugly about his presentation, other than he looked like an idiot, okay? And it didn't reflect well on the truth that he was trying to communicate. It's a silly example. But living life with clarity means that there's people who all they see is the here and now. And just because you know the end of the story doesn't give you permission to get rid of the protocols, to get rid of the manners, to get rid of that which needs to be winsome about you in order to bring them to Christ. We see that living with clarity means in verses 5 and 6, fulfilling personal commitments. Joseph says, "Pharaoh, this is my request. My dad made me promise. And I promised him. Just because I know the end of the story, and I know there's a resurrection. I really know, I honestly do believe that my dad's going to rise someday. And it doesn't matter if it's up in Canaan, or if it's down in Egypt, or over in Timbuktu. It could be in North America for all that matter. It doesn't matter where dad rises from. He's going to rise. That's the important thing. But just because he knows the end of the story, he doesn't give up on his responsibility, on his commitments that he's made to dad to bury him in the land of Canaan. There's some responsibility as well, apparently, to Pharaoh. He gets done with his request in verse 5. He says, Pharaoh, please, I need to leave Egypt. And he wisely doesn't say, because dad doesn't want to be buried here, even though that's what dad said. I need to leave Egypt. I need to bury my dad. And I'll come back. So we see up in verse 13 that it says, or verse 14, after he'd buried his father, Joseph returned. We see in verse 22, and Joseph remained in Egypt. Joseph had a responsibility. Now, how long was Jacob in Egypt after he came down with Joseph? Do you remember that? How many? 14 is about 17 years. Okay, so there were two groups of seven. Seven good years, seven bad years. The seven good years are done. Jacob comes down in the second of the seven bad years. The first 5 years that Jacob's there, famine, bad, horrible stuff. So that's 5 of 17. There's 12 years that he's living. They're not bad years. They're just kind of normal, ordinary years. Now, the famine's done. Joseph's job of preserving life, it's done. So why doesn't he just move his family back up to Canaan? Well, he's got some responsibilities. God put him in that position there in Egypt. He's the second man in charge to just drop that at a moment's notice. Would disrupt social economy and everything at that point in that world power of the day. God didn't call Joseph to do that at that point. He meant for him to stay where he's at and do what he's doing and make an impact for the gospel. He's living, even though he knows the end of the story, he realizes that he needs to fulfill his personal commitments. Verses 7 through 9 talk about the great band that goes with Joseph back to Canaan. It says in verse 7, Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went all the servants of Pharaoh, elders of Pharaoh's household, the elders of the land of Egypt. These are guys that Joseph did work with every day. He did court with. He interacted and he bought lands and he planted overseers and they planted fields. And these were the guys that Joseph worked with. You and I work with people that are both saved and unsaved. And living life with clarity, knowing the end of the story, doesn't remove the unsaved sector from our lives. In fact, we have a responsibility to befriend those that God has us rubbing shoulders with. Exactly because we know the end of the story. And as they go through this process of mourning on the other side of the Jordan, and they follow a route that Israel will follow in their exodus later on, and they stop and they pause, they mourn, and it's a very great mourning. But again, it's not accompanied by the priests. This is a different kind of mourning than what they would have been used to. Even though it's great, even though it's emotional, it would have been different. And these officials get to see, they get to watch, they get to participate in something that's, when we have a funeral here, we bring in folks' loved ones, saved and unsaved, and we sing songs, and we laugh, and we give testimonies, and we talk about seeing them again, and there's a different flavor altogether. We cry, but we sorrow not as those who don't have hope. And in the midst of doing what we're doing, because we know the end of the story, we're rubbing shoulders with people that we know and love, and we're supposed to know and love right here. Knowing the end of the story allows us, it frees us to focus on the present with clarity. Live life to its fullest today. Redeem the time. These days are evil. But when God sends you something to enjoy, enjoy it. When God sends something that rips your heart out, cry. Live life in its fullness. Secondly, we see in the middle story, Joseph dealing with his brothers, that knowing the end of the story frees us to deal with the past with honesty. We see in verses 15 through 28 that it requires Joseph to address the pain of a lingering mistrust. Dad's gone. Now, you notice how they say it there in verse 15. It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back. I mean, it's been 17 years, but what we did to Joseph was really, really, really low. Pay us back for the evil that we, in fact, did to him. So they send a message. Is it a true message? Nobody knows. The way it's crafted, it looks as though it may not be. Jacob certainly had time in the 17 years to talk to Joseph and say, Joseph, now listen, when I'm gone, forgive your brothers. Please, Jacob had that access to Joseph. But the brothers get this story together, and they say in verse 16, and they send the message, they don't take it to them themselves. The message, they said, Joseph, your father told us to tell you this. They don't appeal to him as a brother. They feel they've lost that right. And so they appeal to him in the name of their father. Say, Joseph, you've got an obligation as a son that before he died, please forgive your brothers of their sin. They did do evil to you. And so in verse 17, please forgive us our evil because we're the servants of the God of your father. Okay. You may not count yourself as our brother. We're imploring you in the name of your father. And we're reminding you that we're servants of the same God. Even though your dad is dead, his God isn't. And I know you respect his God. So please. And it says in verse 18, they come in and it says, they fell down before him, again fulfilling that prophetic dream early on, and they say to him, just make us slaves. Kind of like the prodigal son. There's no way my dad would ever accept me. I'm going to go back and I'll fall on his mercy, and I'll ask him just to let me eat what the servants eat. I'll just be a servant. And Joseph has to address this mistrust. Joseph isn't harboring anything at this point. But they're thinking that he is. And when he gets the message, verse 19, end of verse 17. And Joseph wept when they brought this message to him. Guys, really? Do you really think that that's what's going on in my heart? You don't know me. You're afraid of me. You don't know that I love you. We can never be close. They could never be close because up to this point, there had never been a request from them for forgiveness. There had never been an acknowledgement by them of their guilt. So they need to address that. And knowing the end of the story, knowing that they are brothers with a common goal, a common destiny in mind, means they have to take care of that stuff right now. That's why Matthew 18 is so important for us. When anything comes between a brother, in fact, it talks about it early in Matthew, when you're bringing your worship gift to the altar and you know that there's something that's clogging the gears between you and a brother so that there's friction rather than fellowship, take care of it. Take care of it, in fact, because of the destiny that you're sharing. Just because everything's going to be wiped clean later on doesn't mean that I don't have a responsibility to take care of it now. And so Joseph addresses the pain of a lingering mistrust. In verses 19 and 20, he acknowledges the balance of personal responsibility and divine sovereignty. Joseph says in verse 19, I have no responsibility to take a role that is divine. It's reserved for God. Am I God? Is it my place to judge you? Is it my place to exercise vengeance? And three times in Scripture it says, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." David says, "I will not lift up my hand against the Lord's anointed." That's for God to do. Is he doing wrong to me? Absolutely. Okay? God's going to take care of him. Joseph acknowledges he has responsibility and God has sovereignty. He also acknowledges that the brothers had some responsibility in this in verse 19, verse 20. You did mean evil against me. Okay? Let's get this out on the table. What you did was bad. And you meant for it to be bad. Okay? Now, thank you for acknowledging your evil. And you have responsibility for that. I forgive you. But I want you to understand that the way I see your free will exercised in a bad way against me is that God was using it for good. That's how he's able to take the past and bring some sense out of it, because God's in control of this story. We see in verse 21 that enables him to offer a comfort from genuine affection. Verse 21, "Don't fear. I've been taking care of your little ones," and the "I" here is emphatic. "I myself will continue to see that your kids are taken care of. I love you guys." And so he spoke kindly to them. He comforted them. It's the same word that's used of God comforting his people. The only way that we can deal with the past with honesty is to acknowledge, yes, there's wrong. Yes, there's sin. Yes, it hurts. And you did mean it for evil. But, God was even in control of that. And because God was the one who allowed it, I'm willing to accept it. And I can still love you even though you meant to hurt me. That's important. How can I do that? Only because I know the end of the story. We're meant to live together forever. A third way that knowing the end of the story frees me in this life is to face the future, to face it with humility. Come to the end of the passage. Joseph's ready to die, verse 22. Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's house, and he lived for 110 years. He gets to see his grandkids. In verse 24, he says, "I'm about to die." Okay. Knowing the end of the story frees me to face the future with humility. In verse 22, we see that Joseph finds contentment playing his role. Joseph, the second man in the greatest nation on earth of his day, doesn't have plans to do any more than he's already done. He doesn't have plans to grow the people. He doesn't have plans to expand his influence, his territory. He doesn't even have plans to go back to Canaan just yet. He's not going to do that till he's dead. He has a plan to be content with where God's put him today. In verse 23, we see that he takes time to invest in his own family. Oftentimes, folks that get into the ministry, knowing the end of the story, looking to the end of the story, and keeping this in focus, this becomes the focus, and the here and now doesn't. And the focus is so much on ministry and others and getting others in that they lose sight of their own families and they lose their families in the process. Joseph wasn't like that. Joseph had a clear vision of what was in store. And in order for him to be successful, didn't matter if he was the second in all of Egypt. What mattered to him was that his children and grandchildren were a part of the process. And the language that's used there in verse 23 of Manasseh's children being counted as his own, it has the idea of being born on his knees, of Joseph literally adopting Manasseh's sons as his own, even as his sons had been sat upon his father's knee and been formally adopted. Joseph is making sure that these young ones of a second and third generation are brought along to appreciate the inheritance that belongs to them. In verse 24, we see that Joseph takes time to make a point to remember God's word. He calls all his brothers together and says, now listen, guys, God will visit you. He will bring you up out of this land, and he will bring you to the land that he swore, that he promised. God must do this because he promised he would do this to Abraham. He promised it to Isaac. He promised it to Jacob. God must do this because God said he will do this. That's why every Sunday, every Sunday school, every Sunday afternoon, we get this book out. We open it up. And we're concerned primarily about what this book says. It doesn't matter what I say, what our Sunday school teacher says. What matters is how close are we reflecting what this book says. And we take time because we know the end of the story. And the only way we understand it is through this book. In verse 25, we see he has the courage to personalize God's work. Guys, God's going to visit you. And when he does, take my bones with you. The word visit there has the idea of God showing up to alter the course. Sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. But when God shows up, things don't stay the same. God visits. He incarnates. He enters in. He breaks into the story. And Joseph says, when God breaks into the story, make sure I'm a part of it. I want to be there. Take my bones with you. My bones that are going to be preserved with the rest of my body. He's speaking like a Hebrew rather than an Egyptian at this point. And then verse 26, I think, is an important one. Joseph died being 110 years old. They embalmed him and he's put in a coffin in Egypt. Not a pyramid. We don't know where his coffin was. He was in a coffin. But the idea is, because he knows the end of the story, he has the decency to get out of the way. He doesn't have to hold on to anything. He doesn't have to memorialize himself. At the end of the day, he gets out of the way. Because the story isn't about him. It's about God's program. This book is, as we come to the end of Genesis, this book has introduced us to God's program. It's a selective history that's interpreted theologically. It includes judgment. It includes redemption, both of which show a God who's holy. There's key events from the creation, the fall, the flood, the dispersion, the election of a family, and the preservation of a seed. There's key players along the way: Adam, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. And as we get ready to go into the book of Exodus, all of this groundwork has to be laid as the why behind the what of the law. But on a larger scale, Jesus Christ himself sees this Genesis, this book of beginnings, as the prelude to a story that leads and climaxes to himself. In the book of Luke, we have it all going all the way back to Adam, the Son of God, from whom Jesus Christ came. I like how Robert Alter closes up this book of Genesis. He says, this book that began with an image of God's breath moving across the vast expanse of the primordial deep to bring about the world and all life into being ends with the image of a body in a box, a mummy in a coffin. Now, Exodus begins with a proliferation of births, a pointed repetition of the primeval blessing of being fruitful and multiplying. And just as the survival of the flood was represented as a second creation, the leader who is to forge the creation of the new nation will be born on the water in a little box. But this time it's not the coffin at the end of Genesis. It's the ark that keeps Noah and the seed alive. And then you have the birth of little Moses. And the story keeps on going. But as we live our lives, all we see is the here and now. But the only way we can do the here and now well is as we bear hard in the direction of our destination. Stay on track. Keep it in sight. Don't lose sight of where you're going just because it gets hard now. Understand that your story today is just a part of God's bigger story. That's why we've been looking at the book of Genesis. Your story matters, and it matters today. So play your part well by keeping your eye on the end of the story.